Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Exclusively for the Generation Y podcast fans, True Crime Magazine is giving away 100 two-year subscriptions for only $20, an over $100 value. Yes, you heard that right, less than $1 a month. And the offer gets better and better. For the next 48 hours, they're slipping two more best-selling true crime publications worth nearly $140 into all Ultimate bundles with little to no additional cost. Head over to thecrimemag.com/generationY to learn more. That's thecrimemag.com/generationY. I'm good, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing great. I wanted to quickly thank all the listeners for the outpour of love and support from our last episode about the Brock Turner Stanford case. A quick update, our Gen Y app, mobile app, will probably be dead soon, and we won't be replacing it anytime soon. I'm sorry. So if you are listening to us through our app, please go out and subscribe to us somewhere else. Also, our website, thegenerationypodcast.com, might be down for a bit also, but you can always go to our genypod.com and find all our merch and all of our premium episodes.
CrimeCon, May 4th through 6th, we'll be there. And then we have a meetup in St. Paul, Minnesota, June 16th. For details, go to our Facebook page or send us a message if you can't find that Facebook page on the events tab. We did reach out for some help on pronunciations. Again, I have to say we're Americans. Pronouncing things in other languages can be a little tricky. So I did hear from a woman in Switzerland. Her name's Aurelia. She's incredible. She even sent an audio file of her pronouncing some of these names and things, but it's still tricky.
And I got help from my buddy out in LA, Eric Lampere, who has a podcast called Topical Island. That's like a topical cream. He was just an endless help for me, but of course that was days ago. And by the time I get around to actually trying to pronounce anything on this episode, it'll probably all be for nothing. But thank you, Eric. So obviously if we're seeking help for how to pronounce things, then this is a international case. It takes place on October 16th, 1984. It happens in a small village in Le Pange, Cervelone, France. We have a mother and father, Jean-Marie and Christine, their four-year-old, Gregory. Christine picks him up from daycare and brings him home. And it's just before 5 p.m. Christine is doing some housework, and their son, Gregory, is playing outside in a sandbox or just sort of a sand area where there was construction and stuff in the front yard. It's a warm, sunny, beautiful day. It's fall. It's October. And around 5:15, Christine, she looks out the window, and she doesn't see her child playing in the front yard. He's not in her view. So, of course, as most mothers or parents, as soon as your kid's outside of your field of view, you panic a little bit. She goes outside. She's looking around for him. She goes over to the babysitter's house trying to find him. But 5:30 p.m., Michael Villamon, who's Gregory's uncle, John Marie's brother, gets a call from an anonymous caller, somebody who's muffled their voice, weird, and you know, it's like, he can't tell if it's a male or female. It's just somebody being mysterious and creepy. And they say, "I've taken the boy of the chief," meaning Gregory's father. He's the chief. "And I've thrown him into the Valone," which is a river nearby. Now, Gregory's father, he is a boss or supervisor at the local plant. So he's the chief. So this is the whole situation here. There's a phone call, an anonymous caller saying, "I've taken the boy and I've thrown him into the river."
So at this point, little Gregory is missing, yet there's a clue. If this caller was correct, if their claim is real, then that means that this little boy has probably been killed.
And thrown in the river. Yeah.
It's horrifying. Getting a call like that, that's terror.
At this point, both John Marie and Michael are searching through the woods, and they're calling the police to help with the search because they know now that this wasn't their kid just running away, running off, and is just lost down the street. Somebody said, "I took your boy." At the same exact moment, he's missing.
Unfortunately, they locate the body of little Gregory at a bend in the Valone River. And worse, his ankles and his hands were both bound with rope. He was wearing his blue raincoat, and his woolen hat had been pulled down over his face.
Now, if you live in France or even Europe for that matter, back in the 80s, this was big news. This was like JonBenet in the States or Madeleine McCann, you know, huge story, because this little town doesn't have problems like this. And child abduction, I guess, wasn't that prevalent over there.
Well, and this case continues to, according from what I've read, to be the biggest case in France. And I think a big part of that is because you have a little boy that was kidnapped and murdered, but you also have the mystery of who is the caller? Who is this person making the threats? And who abducted and killed this boy? So there's a lot of mystery here.
Oh yeah, and the plot's about to thicken. But the media will nickname the boy Little Gregory, Petit Gregory. And on October 17th, 1984, the family received a letter. And it said, "I hope that you die from sorrow, boss. Even your money cannot give you back your son. This is my vengeance." And then they insult him with some curse words. This was the last anonymous letter that the family would receive. People are shocked, and it's weird that whoever's done this is now continuing to terrorize the family. The family actually had been terrorized before this. So this isn't the first time they've received threatening calls or letters. So kind of weird, right?
Right. And the judge who was put in charge of organizing these inquiries that would start to happen, the media seemed to have a field day with him because they considered him to be rather green.
Yeah, he was very young.
Yeah, he was in his early 30s. And so they were calling him the petite judge, the little judge.
Which I find that kind of offensive, because you have a murdered boy and he's the little Gregory. And then you're saying the judge is little judge. I just don't like the association there, but you know.
Everyone's opinions will probably differ on this, but probably most who have looked into this case will say that because this judge was green, he was kind of manipulated to where he would give up information that he probably shouldn't have been talking about to the press. There's that whole question of when you have an investigation, how well is it carried out? And we talk so many times about, well, this case was handled this way, this one was handled that way. In this one, it seemed like a lot of information was spilling out to the public when some of it probably should have been kept, you know, close to the vest for these investigators. And yet everybody wanted to know what happened. So they wanted every bit of information they could get out of the judge, out of the gendarmes, the police.
And which I get the police and the prosecutor and anyone associated with the case will be questioned by the media, but I'm surprised that they were able to get all the way to the judge. But then again, small town, so people are very accessible there.
An autopsy is conducted on Gregory, and some very interesting information comes out of it. One is that the water inside of his lungs, which indicated that he had drowned, it seemed to be from more of like what would be expected in a bathtub rather than what would have been in the river.
But this doesn't come out right away, so they just assume, oh, he was bound and then dropped into the river, so that was his demise. Not he was taken somewhere and then murdered and then dumped. So a little bit of a discrepancy there, not discrepancy, but a little bit of a lack of investigation at first that confused people.
And to further clarify, the water in his lungs didn't have microscopic organisms that you would find in river water. So they felt it was too clean. And so there was a question of whether maybe he had been drowned in a tub first. They didn't find any obvious signs of bruising, so it didn't seem like there were any indications that he was forcibly taken. They also, in conducting a search, and this was a few days after Gregory was found, police found a hypodermic syringe and empty vial of insulin in a box near the riverbank. This is interesting because during the autopsy, there was a little bit of insulin found, or at least an indication of it. And I don't know if this is a lucky break, but they said that finding insulin in someone's system, if they had been injected with it, it's kind of a crapshoot. You may not find evidence later of it.
Possibly they were using this to shock his system, to kill him in a more humane manner or something. What was the point of that?
First I'll go over what they thought happened. Given that this might be tied to the crime, they think that someone grabbed him, tied him up, and of course pulled his hat over his head or over his face, and then injected the boy with this. What it would do is it might just shut him down.
Incapacitate him, all right.
Where he would be unconscious when he hit the water, and then he would just drown. But again, this is trying to put together what may have happened. Unfortunately, during the autopsy, which a lot of people say was botched, there were a lot of things they just didn't check. They didn't look for a needle mark. Again, they didn't find this syringe until a few days later. But man, you would think they would have gone back and looked for a needle mark, because then they could establish, okay, then this may have been connected. Back then, they didn't have DNA testing. They couldn't just take this syringe and run some tests on it and see if it had come into contact with Gregory. So this is where you have to put it together and say, yeah, we found a needle mark in his neck or on his leg or in his shoulder, but they didn't do that. They never looked for one.
And they were able to detect the insulin, but when it comes to a suspect, maybe the person might be diabetic. I mean, I know anyone can probably get their hands on a syringe and insulin, but if they already had it, hey, it might be a clue.
So now the next step is to ask the question, who would harm this little boy? And was there anything leading up to that event that would clue us into who it could have been?
And here we are. It's obviously a 4-year-old hasn't made any enemies yet. A 4-year-old hasn't done anything. So this is obviously targeting his parents with the phone call and this letter. It's somebody that's wanting to punish them and extract revenge on them.
Well, it turns out there is a lot of drama with this family.
And it's a pretty large family too, right?
Right. This is an area on the eastern edge of France. There are a lot of rivalries going on within this family. Most notably, it seems, between some of the Villemont clan and the LaRoches.
And the father had been promoted at work and was the boss. And there's this idea that there was jealousy, that he didn't deserve this position, or just the fact that he got the position, somebody else didn't.
Okay, so this kind of thing goes on today. It's always gone on. There are people who like to flaunt that they have money or boast that they're successful. And then there are some people out there that really get irritated by that. And some, they get enraged. And this is something that may have happened in this case. The police were wondering if Jean-Marie's personality, not to say that he asked for this to happen, but it might explain why someone was so angry, because Jean-Marie had a reputation for boasting about his success at work and talking about how much his house cost. It was a $50,000 house, and he was talking about having leather and oak furniture. And this is something that he would tell everyone about. It may have rubbed some people the wrong way.
And you know what? At least even with my family, it doesn't matter if you boast about it. If you're just more successful than somebody else who feels entitled or feels they need that money, they're going to hate you regardless.
Yeah, it's difficult to say, but this is the lead they're working off of. Mm-hmm. And the first person they focus on, now keep in mind, as part of their investigation, they start uncovering phone calls and letters to quite a number of people in the Villemont clan. So you have uncles, you have father of Jean-Marie, on and on and on. Different people getting calls, letters. This is a lot like the Circleville letter case, if you've heard that on our podcast. And it all stems quite possibly from a film. There was a film made in 1943 while France was occupied by Nazi Germany, and it was known as Le Corbeau, or The Crow.
And so this film was about a small town that's being torn apart from harassing letters that are being written by an anonymous source that knows everybody's secrets and is pitting them against each other. I watched the trailer for the movie. It actually looks kind of interesting, and I'm really not into black and white movies, but I might go out and watch this movie now because it's sort of interesting. But this whole situation, the letter writer is now going to be referred to as The Crow because of this movie. So again, we've covering a case that's sort of inspired by cinema.
Right. The family really felt like it was someone that knew them, because the letters and the calls that would come in would reference things that were very recent, sometimes just minutes before. So it's like they were spying on them and could give them information. And I think what that was building up the terror. It was someone that was able to say, I know what you just did. Another thing I want to talk about is how Jean-Marie's father, his name's Albert Villemont, he actually had his phones tapped by the police. And right after that, the phone calls ended to him. So he didn't get any more after that. Now, why is that? It's because he was being watched.
Or he told somebody, I'm having the cops tap my phones. He told the person that was writing the letters and calling. We don't know.
Well, we have some idea because he went out for a walk one time with someone. And when he got back, he got a call and he was asked, how did you enjoy your walk?
Yeah.
So whoever's making the calls was within sight of some of these family members.
Creepy.
And that's really, really creepy. So it's someone who has a personal vendetta against Jean-Marie, it seems, right? Because he kept referencing him as boss and then referencing little Gregory as little boss.
So this is a major grudge here. I don't care how much of a grudge you have against somebody, going after a child, that's some psychotic stuff right there.
Oh, it absolutely is. Whoever was calling, and I actually was able to find some audio that had been recorded of this caller known as The Crow, they had a very hoarse voice. You could tell they were trying to manipulate their voice in some way so that you couldn't identify them. In my opinion, the caller was a woman.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
We'll play part of the call for you so you can get an idea of what it sounded like.
Ça peut être intéressant pour moi.
Bon, je t'ai entendu, comme quand on parlait de tout le monde à côté, il est aussi pour ton père.
Donc qui c'est moi?
T'as pas rien à chercher, j'ai téléphoné, il y a toi qui es pour
moi. These calls and harassing letters started before the disappearance of this child and the murder of this child. So the family was already being harassed, but now it takes a darker turn to terrorizing them.
The first contact from the Crow happened in 1979. So this is a full 4 to 5 years before little Gregory is taken and killed. That's a lot of time to go by, and that's dedication or obsession, maybe?
A lot of hate.
So the question is, I know hindsight is 2020. But if you're receiving a lot of threatening calls and your relatives are getting threatening calls and letters as well, why would you not watch your boy in the yard? I mean, she didn't look out for him or anything for 20 to 25 minutes while she's doing housework. I know she's probably got a lot to do, but I guess that's just trusting the world you live in because nothing like that ever happens there, right? But they're getting all these harassing calls and stuff. So,
well, I mean, I just not to try to give her a pass or bash on her more, but it's 1984. It's a different world. People feel a little safer back then. But a four-year-old, I mean, can he run out into the street, get hit by a car? I mean, there's a lot of things that can happen here. You want to keep an eye on your kid.
I'm not saying she's at fault here, but it just seems weird that they've been getting all these calls. Unless maybe it had gone on for so long, they never really felt the fear, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. It was just a daily occurrence.
It was said that Jean-Marie was asked about this. Apparently, the Crow had even mentioned how he knew that it wasn't working, that the threats were not working. And it wasn't until he actually threatened Jean-Marie's son that he got a real reaction out of Jean-Marie. So maybe this is something that just developed over time. And because this caller really wanted to get to Jean-Marie, they felt like they had to do something this devastating to him to really hurt him. Because everything they had tried, everything this crow had tried before, didn't really work. And so maybe that explains why they didn't feel any fear and weren't paranoid about where Gregory was.
Well, I just think of the internet today and people that troll and cyberbully, and you don't take a lot of it seriously. But then when somebody shifts it to threatening you or doxing you or pointing something out that's very personalized, that's when it shifts. But for the most part, you know, what do you do? Now, it's obvious that this person knows the family, is very intimate with the family. I mean, they're being watched. They know that Jean-Marie has been promoted at work. This reminds me a little bit of the JonBenet Ramsey case, with they knew exactly how much the bonus, the Christmas bonus was of the father, things like that. It's really creepy.
The first suspect in the case is a man by the name of Bernard LaRoche, and he's a relative. Of course, with any family, you have different sections. In this family, you have the Villemans, you have the Jacobs, you have the LaRoches, and LaRoches are sort of on the other side.
So Bernard LaRoche, BL is his initials.
Yes. Bernard was not like Jean-Marie. He was, he wasn't boastful, but he was very crass, I guess. And he had a mustache. He was kind of a bigger guy. He didn't really like Jean-Marie. I guess they grew up as friends, even though they're related, but they grew up as friends and they drifted apart. And there's this idea from all these different witnesses who said that Bernard grew up pretty upset with Jean-Marie. He didn't like the man he'd become. He didn't like that he had all this money.
He was more a working man, gets his hands dirty, and Jean-Marie was the boastful, materialistic jerk.
Exactly. So they drifted apart. Even after what had happened to little Gregory, Bernard seemed to indicate that, I mean, at least this is the way I took it, that Jean-Marie brought this on.
So no sympathy for a dead kid. It's pretty harsh.
So the police are looking at Bernard and thinking, we can start with you.
And they have all these letters that they've collected from the family members. They have all this evidence.
And there were even recordings made of the crow's calls.
Yeah. What they do find on one of the letters is what they think is an imprint of a BL. So, you know, if you take two pieces of paper and you're writing on top of one, the second layer will have the impression or the indention of the letter. Again, this is very similar to what I, you know, see at the JonBenet Ramsey case, where you see that there were multiple attempts at writing a letter, the ransom letter. So they have what they believe is a BL on one of these letters that's written, right?
Right. And so Bernard, he's 29. He's a cousin of Jean-Marie. He's being looked at as possibly the crow. And his wife, Marie, they both go in, they're questioned, then they're released. But the police couldn't get them to break. They were trying to get them to confess. They said, hey, we've got this evidence. You've made these statements that are very inflammatory. Tell us what happened. He wasn't giving up anything. He said he was innocent. They ended up letting him go. But his wife's sister, Marie's younger sister, Muriel, told the police that Bernard had picked her up from school that afternoon of the murder, and that they had picked up Gregory from his front yard and drove nearby the river, okay? And then she said they went off, only Bernard came back. So she's telling the police that basically Bernard killed little Gregory.
Yeah. And don't get all the names of all these different family members, you know, confused. Just know that we have a witness that says she was picked up by Bernard and he got the child and then took him to the river. So that's all the police need. They have a witness that places Bernard with the child, and they have what they consider this BL imprinted on a poisoned pen letter to the family.
So in November of 84, the police arrest Bernard, and he's charged with the murder and kidnapping of little Gregory. he ends up going to prison. So everybody seems to think, yep, we've got this case solved. Now we can move on finally, right? Because this was the story in France. And now the police have a victory. They say, yep, we've got the guy. He's in prison, right?
But our witness changes her tune.
Yeah, she goes on television and said that the police coerced the story out of her.
So she never was picked up from school. She rode the bus home. So therefore, she wasn't with Bernard picking up Gregory and dumping him in the river. She's totally recanted. And also, they asked her, what did the bus driver look like? She gives a completely wrong description of the bus driver that day. So if she actually had ridden the bus that day, wouldn't she know what he looked like? They ask other people on the bus, do you remember seeing her riding home that day? And they're like, no.
The police don't buy this because they have witnesses who said they saw a mustached man with a woman in the area. And there were various witnesses who saw this couple throughout the day and said it was a guy with a mustache and there was a woman with him. And when people, you look at pictures of Bernard and his wife's sister, it kind of fits. You almost think, well, maybe it's them.
Yeah. So is her story falling apart here, or is she just misremembering? That's the question.
Or did her older sister coerce her into changing her story?
Yeah. It's either the cops or it's her older sister. And so far, the evidence is kind of on the older sister.
And what I had read was she described the bus driver, but she described the bus driver who had worked other days, but not that day. So that's really fishy. And again, it sounds like she's been coerced by her sister. Again, we're just trying to use our judgment here. This isn't court of law stuff. So anyway, they can't get Bernard to break. They can't get his wife to break. They can't get this younger sister of Bernard's wife to break. It looks like they don't really have the guy. They don't have the crow.
Well, let's put it this way. They don't have enough evidence to go forward with a trial. I mean, they indicted him. The prosecution and the judge are like, we don't have enough here. So let him out.
Yeah. February 4th, 1985, they released Bernard LaRoche. The district attorney doesn't like this. They feel like they got the right guy. But the people that matter, like the judge, no, this isn't working out. Let him go.
This doesn't look good because people already don't respect this judge because he's green, he's young, he doesn't know what he's doing, and this is just more ammo against him. He's, well, he just let out the murderer.
Also, Jean-Marie believes that they had the right guy. He believes that his cousin, Bernard, is the killer of little Gregory.
Well, just imagine you're a father. Your boy has been murdered. You're seeing red. They've actually charged somebody, put him behind bars, and had all this evidence. Flimsy maybe, but they had evidence. You're not going to listen to reason. You're not going to listen to anything. You know that this is the guy.
And so there's probably some blind rage here. But there's also the witnesses that said they saw this man with a mustache. The way they describe him, it sounds a lot like Bernard. Remember, Bernard and Jean-Marie don't get along. So it's not looking good. What really sends us over the edge, because Jean-Marie makes some threats against Bernard's life. And he doesn't like that he's out of prison.
And he doesn't send anonymous letters when he does it either.
The police now shift their focus and start looking at Christine Villemon, Jean-Marie's wife, the mother of little Gregory. Jean-Marie just gets more and more upset. He reaches his breaking point on March 29th, 1985, when he shoots Bernard in public with a hunting rifle and kills him after he had left work.
Vigilante justice here.
They said that he goes and visits his wife, and then he turns himself in. He has no problem taking credit for killing the man he says killed his little boy.
Yeah, he's like, I killed the crow. I killed the murderer of my boy. And I'm not hiding behind any mask, anything. It was me, and you know why I did it.
Yeah, and you wonder if the public could kind of feel for him. I know that Bernard's wife had something put on his tombstone to the effect of, he was killed by blind hatred, by blind rage, something like that. And I also get the sense, though, that she puts the blame on the media and on the police, because this whole time they're building this case up in the public against Bernard. And you know how public opinion goes. If you convince the public of something, it becomes the truth, no matter if it's the truth or not. She could have easily said, Jean-Marie is a terrible person. I want something done. But I got the sense that she felt like this was just a really unfortunate circumstance brought on by the police and by the media.
Perfect storm. And she's standing by her husband.
Yeah, she continues to say he was innocent. They had nothing to do with what happened to little Gregory. But the police, well, this is 6 months down the road. They believe that he had been put into the river by his mother.
What was the case we just covered about the mother and the daughter that disappeared?
Leochi.
Yeah, this is sort of simple explanations here. Is who was the last person to see the child alive? And it is Christine in this case.
So what's the evidence against Christine? Well, again, the water inside of Gregory's lungs didn't seem to match what would have been found in the river. There were also some tire tracks by the river that would have matched a Renault Ami, but that's the exact car that Christine drives. Only she no longer has it in her possession. She had sold the car.
And they never really did a plaster cast of the tracks and did a side-by-side comparison. So again, the media pointing out the botched investigation and such.
Well, by the time they got to the car, the tires had been used so much that there was no way to compare. They also found some rope inside of the residence of the Villemans, Christine and Jean-Marie's place, that looked a lot like the rope that was used on the boy, but they couldn't make an exact match, but it looked very similar. And there was also a visit to the postal office shortly before the murder, before the kidnapping and the murder of little Gregory. And it would have been the right amount of time where if she had mailed off a letter from the Crow, that it would have arrived when it did. And she claims that these witnesses who said she was at the post office have it wrong, that she wasn't there. So the last letter that was sent was postmarked at 5:15 p.m. That was on October 16th. But, you know, they couldn't confirm that she was there on that day. They did see that she had sent a letter on October 15th, and they were able to track that letter down, but it had nothing to do with the Crow or this case at all. They did a comparison of writing samples from her and the letter writer. You know, they're getting this idea that maybe she did write the letters. But they also said that about Bernard, and we know how that turned out. I don't think we talked about that earlier, but a big part of this case is looking at the writing, because that's physical evidence. They have these letters and they have these phone calls. Well, at the time with the phone calls, all they can do is listen to the calls. But with this, they can actually look at the way that the letters are written and they can kind of tell whether someone may have written it or not. Again, it's like an odds thing. But while they looked at Bernard, now they're looking at the mother and thinking she could have done this. Again, she had up to 25 minutes where she didn't even check on her boy and he goes missing. So there are some people out there that would say, yeah, she just made that up. And Christine claims that the rope that they found was actually given to her by Bernard LaRoche. So again, you tie it back to Bernard. It's almost like she's saying, hey, the original guy you were looking at, why don't you go look at him again?
Well, and this is the problem is if all you look at is just the fluid in the lungs, the possibility that this rope matches the same rope that was used in his binding, possible witness testimony that she was at a post office the day before. This looks very bad for her. But I look at the long game here. Was she the original Crow that started up to 5 years prior? Or did she maybe write this letter to put blame on the Crow when she went off on a rage and killed her son? Does she know who the Crow is? If she thinks the crow's Bernard, then this is another way that she's placing blame on him.
As far as I know, they feel that all of the letters were written by the same person. But again, I mean, how good is their writing analysis? I don't know. I do know that Christine wasn't exactly welcomed by the Villemont family. Jean-Marie fell in love with her. They got married, but she wasn't very well accepted. And again, this comes down to money. I think part of it was that she didn't come from a well-to-do family at all. And so some in the Villemont clan just didn't really accept her. That fuels the speculation. Hey, she wasn't well-liked. They have this little boy. Everyone loves the little boy, but no one really likes her. So maybe this is her way of making things work out for her. You know, she's willing to sacrifice her boy to get maybe her husband even more on her side. Because after her husband shoots and kills Bernard LaRoche, he goes to her and says, I did this for you. This really seemed to strengthen their relationship.
Now, I don't really understand jealousy. I probably can't understand most people's motivations to murder other people. So her being the prime suspect, her murdering her own child, but having this weird long game of writing letters for up to 5 years, talking about jealousy and him getting a promotion at work, and just being outrageously horrible. Most of us normal people, we can't put ourselves in that mindset. And so my only speculation or my only, I guess, question against her is, what is her motivation? But really, who has motivation here? I mean, even if it was Bernard, he hates this other guy so much that he's going to kill his child. Like, I can't wrap my head around these motives.
Yeah, Bernard had a child of his own, a young child. There are going to be people who believe that Bernard is the person responsible. That's all there is to it. But really, to catch you up, Bernard was the first suspect. He was arrested, and then later they had to release him because they just didn't have enough evidence. Christine is arrested. She is, I understand, to be devastated by the arrest. I mean, she was the mother of this little boy, and being accused of his murder was just too much. And so when she was arrested in July of 1985, she goes on a hunger strike. At this time, she's pregnant, 6 months pregnant with their second child. This is not good. And I don't think anybody was going to sit by and just say, that's your choice. I think what it does is it speeds up the process. They really have to make sure they're doing the right thing here, because if they're putting the mother through this and they're wrong, this is not going to go well.
And the media's already got everybody under a microscope anyway, so they got to really speed up the process.
Well, it's about 11 days later when the district attorney says that they don't have enough evidence and they release her. Jean-Marie and Christine's second son, Julian, is born in October of 1985. Now, while they don't have enough evidence to keep her in custody, they're still going to charge her with the murder of her son. They're just not going to, you know, hold her. So there's no hunger strike. But in December of 1986, she goes to court. Her attorney says, hey, you don't have anything on my client. You need to let her go. The appeal court of Dijon, they make a decision here. They say that the case has a lot of errors, and they replace the judge, Judge Lambert. They take him off the case, and they put in a judge by the name of Maurice Simon. He had a lot more experience. This is not a green judge. They put in an experienced judge. Jean-Marie was sent to prison for the murder of Bernard LaRoche. Judge Simon orders Jean-Marie to be bailed. He's going to go to trial for the murder of Bernard LaRoche. And this is late December of 1987. Jean-Marie pleads guilty. You know, he said, I did it. Again, like what you said, Justin, he doesn't have any problem talking about what he did. He pled guilty. So the judge sentences him to 5 years in prison with 1 year suspended. So that's 4 years. And if you add in his previous time, he only ended up spending a few more weeks in prison before he gets out. And he got out.
for shooting somebody in cold blood in broad daylight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I get that it probably would have been considered second degree murder, crime of passion sort of deal, but still.
Yeah, I'm sure they're taking into account he's probably not a danger to anyone because he killed the man who killed his son in his mind. So all is good. He can continue on with his life. But yeah, it's not very satisfying. Then again, I think we're looking at empathy here. I think people look at this father and think, well, if my boy had been killed, what would I do?
Kill somebody. Not that I would, but that's just the knee-jerk reaction.
The case continues to be investigated. By February of 1993, Christine, who is still a suspect, was then declared non-lieu. Basically, you know, her case wasn't proven. Really, what I got out of it was it seemed like the court was saying, yeah, you're completely innocent. So Bernard's dead. All the evidence seems to say that he made a good suspect, but there wasn't enough evidence to say he was the crow. And then Christine, the mother, they really investigated her. They had all these little pieces that kind of added up to, yeah, she could have been the killer. She could have been the crow, but it didn't pan out either. In fact, like I said, the court seemed to decide she had nothing to do with it.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
So we're left with nobody is being charged with this crime of killing this four-year-old boy. We're left with no resolve here.
Years go by, and really, Jean-Marie and Christine don't give up. With all that they had been through, with all that Jean-Marie put other people through because of the craziness of this case and his rage and the feeling just that the police weren't getting this investigation done properly, it felt hopeless. But they continued to press for answers. And in 2000, the case was officially reopened because at that point, they felt like they could do some things differently. Obviously, the original judge made some errors. The police made some errors. But what they do have is evidence. They were able to hold on to the evidence in the case, and they could then do DNA testing. And one of the things they did in this case, and they've done it in other cases like the Zodiac, is they took stamps that were used on the letters, and they did DNA tests on those stamps. Because if you lick a stamp, your DNA is left behind. Well, so they test the stamps, but the sample's too degraded to get any real results where they can actually make some comparisons. And it's not until December of 2008 when they do some more DNA testing.
This is on the rope that was used, right?
Right. They had the rope that had bound Gregory's wrists. They also tested another letter and some more evidence. Anyway, tests were again done in 2013. Nothing's matching anything, which is very frustrating. Now, that doesn't stop them because they're using other things as well. They're doing more letter writing analysis. They're really taking a look at these calls. They're using a program that takes all of the information. It's a software program. And with all of the information they've collected, so when you build timelines for suspects, this person was here, they were there at this time and on this date. And what they do is the software program looks to see if there are any holes where someone could have operated and murdered this kid, taken this kid and murdered him. It's just, you know, everything's coming up, no lead. They can't come up with anything. They continue to question people in the family. no matter what they've tried, they keep hitting dead ends. And this may be a result of the investigation not being well done. It really started with the autopsy, I think. When they were doing the autopsy, there were certain things they just didn't do.
Well, the problem here is we were working with a 30, almost 40-year-old case. Even if they did a bang-up job originally, evidence degrades. DNA doesn't stick around forever. So they're doing their best. But if they didn't do a good investigation, collect all these items properly, or cross-contamination, chain of custody, there's no answer here. I think we have two good suspects. I would actually lean a little bit more towards the mother, but that doesn't mean I don't want my opinion to influence anybody on that. But if Bernard was the crow on his deathbed, I don't expect anyone to admit or confess, but why wouldn't he? You know, why wouldn't he say something to the effect of, okay, it was me. Screw you guys. I got away with it.
But in 2017, more arrests are made in this case. The people who are picked up are the aunt and uncle of Jean-Marie, Marcel and Jacqueline Jacob. Now, they're in their 70s at this point. His brother's wife, Jeanette Villemon, who is in her 60s, was also arrested. They released her, but Marcel and Jacqueline remained in custody. They charged them with kidnapping and confinement. The prosecutor is, I don't know, I think he's keeping things closer to his vest, but he is saying that they are nearing the truth. The question is, what did they have on these people? Because, as I said, they did DNA testing, they did letter writing analysis, they had a computer program that was mapping all of the suspects and the evidence in time and in space so that they could figure out if they could come up with a good suspect, someone who fit into this case the right way. I believe the real key to Jacqueline and Marcel Jacob being arrested is their daughter, Valerie. Now, Valerie was estranged from her parents because she didn't like their lifestyle and she didn't like the relationship. So to her, they were a swinging couple. She said her mother ran everything. So while her dad was like this tough guy, she said her mother ran everything. Her mother was in charge. Her parents were workers at a factory. They also, like Bernard, had a major issue with Jean-Marie's success and his boasting. So their daughter Valerie puts forth all this evidence and gives all this testimony that is really damning towards her own parents. In a letter written in 1991, and this is after Jacqueline broke up with her husband, in this letter, she talks about how she was forced to return to the home by her husband. According to their daughter, this just doesn't seem right because her mother was so in charge. She thinks that the real situation is that her dad has something on her mom. And that would be maybe, of course, as we can think is what is being alluded to, is that they know something about this crime. And so even though her mom wanted to leave her husband, well, he can pull her back in because he's got some dirt on her. But she's upset about it and she's written about it. But that's just speculation. Now, in one of the calls from the crow, they can hear in the background some footsteps going downstairs. They counted the number of steps. And it just so happens that there were 13 steps that they heard. And there are 13 steps in the Jacobs home. Though it might be, what, a coincidence, right?
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't tell me a whole lot just because we had a piece of paper with initials on it. I mean, it's all circumstantial things.
The other thing, though, is they're noticing that the Jacobs look a lot like the people that were described by the witnesses. Why? Because, like Bernard, Marcel is kind of a bigger guy, and he has a mustache. And they're thinking, wait a minute, they could be the people that were seen. Adding to that, and I think this is even more interesting, is that Valerie talked about how her parents always used their binoculars. And the witnesses, some of them had described seeing binoculars around the necks of these people. And so that's another very interesting coincidence. This case isn't locked down, you know. I mean, we haven't heard anything that suggests that they're ready to move forward and they've got everything lined up and they're going to get murder convictions here. But I don't know. They might just have something. Problem, though, is that this couple claims that they have a solid alibi. They're saying they're innocent and they were actually in a meeting where they work. And this meeting took place over the course of an afternoon. So it would not fit with the time of the crime. They couldn't be the perpetrators, right? The police will say, we checked into this and you didn't punch a card to go to the meeting. They don't really know if there's real proof that they went to this meeting. All they know is that this couple says that they were at the meeting. But
there's no way to really confirm this alibi.
That's right. So it's an unconfirmed alibi, but they're sticking with it. They're saying that they have an alibi. So that's kind of up in the air. But this is the kind of case where we're going to wait and see what happens. But what I find interesting about it is everything that seemed to work for Bernard also works for Marcel. Maybe they were onto something originally and they just had the wrong guy. The other thing we know is, and if you listen to the call, it really does sound like a woman. And they believe that there were two people working this poison pen and harassing call scheme. Because there's this person who sounds to me like a woman. I mean, I guess you could say it's probably someone who has like a handkerchief over the phone. And then if you look at it the way Valerie describes it, you can almost picture that her mother is the caller and that it was her father who was the one who was able to grab the little boy.
Because now this throws Christine, the mother of Gregory, out the window if it's a team of people, two people working this. Because who would Christine work with to murder her own child? It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. I'm sure somebody can come up with something and say, oh, she worked with her husband. But, you know, this family was devastated. Jean-Marie and Christine, they'd have to be incredible actors, I think. Jean-Marie was so mad, he went and shot someone dead over this. Yeah, I just don't see it. I really don't believe that Christine or Jean-Marie had anything to do with their son's murder.
And then you look at Bernard and his wife. Well, possibly Bernard is a good suspect, but we don't have much on his wife. And did she hold the same hatred? Was she in the same mindset as Bernard? Who knows? Just because you're married to somebody doesn't mean that you're working in cahoots with them. So Bernard, I feel, is a decent suspect, but even after his death, nothing comes of that. So then we have this third party as suspects.
Again, writing analysis comes through and it seems to indicate that Jacqueline may have written at least two of four anonymous letters written by the Crow. I don't know how much stock I put into that because they've said several times now that someone seems to match it. They do have evidence that this couple was very upset with Jean-Marie. They had the same kind of beef that Bernard had. That kind of falls in line. At this point, I would say I'm happy that they're trying to solve this case. I mean, no one wants a little boy to die and for there to be no justice. But you also have to be skeptical because they've tried this so many times and it's failed. And really, it's been two times, but that's enough times for me. I mean, how many times do you have to go through this before you say, maybe we just can't figure it out? I hate to give up, but the police, they're not looking at it that way. They're looking at it as, we're going to solve this case.
I mean, I understand there's no statute of limitation on murder. But what can they do now, especially against this older couple? I'm sure that a jury is going to look at them very sympathetically. Like, are we going to put these people away behind bars for something that happened 40 years ago and their life is close to being over? I don't know. I don't know how that works out. I think they're going to have to really have some solid evidence and nail them to the wall before a jury or judge is going to throw the book at them.
Yeah, I don't know what they'll use, but I know they can use the picture of little Gregory because he's this cute, curly-haired little boy with a great smile. And I know that will hit hearts a lot faster than an elderly couple will. You know, that's just how it is. Whether they have enough to really go forward with this, I don't know. It reminds me of the Holly Bobo case in a way because in that case, they have someone who spoke up and said, I have the information you need, but Were they doing it to save their own skin because they figured there was no way out? I don't know. I know a lot of people tend to believe that person, but in this case, you have someone who doesn't like the couple. It's their own daughter, and she's cooperating with the police and feeding them this information and building up these characters who could be killers. You know, we don't understand people's motivations, as you said earlier, Justin. So I'm trying to remain open-minded with this and just say I will be watching for updates on this case to find out what happens. The reason I wanted to cover it now is because of the arrests. The case is too famous not to cover. I mean, it's huge in France. It's not big over here, but it really could be. And so it's just a matter of time before people would start saying, hey, you need to cover this. So why not cover it now? And, you know, and if something breaks, we can always do an update down the road.
Well, there's so many weird facets about it with the letter writing, the phone calls, time passed, a revenge killing. It's just, I hope we told the story in a coherent manner because there's so much going on. But of course, it's in France, so it doesn't get the same airplay here in the States that it does in other places. There are really crazy cases that happen in other countries. There's one that I've asked Aaron to put on the schedule, and it's a crazy revenge case that I'm hoping to talk about because, hey, we can't just pick on America all the time. There's the rest of you all have some crazy stuff going on.
And really, there are so many different rabbit holes you could go down with this case. You could literally go down one and end up at a theory that says to you, it's this person that did it. For people that think that Bernard was in cahoots with his niece, they would say that they fit the descriptions of the people seen by the witnesses. They would say that the bus driver who actually drove the bus on the day that supposedly she took the bus home said she was not on the bus. He maintains that. He was very, very certain that she was not on the bus. A nurse who was treating Bernard's wife said that she taught Muriel how to use a syringe and how to administer insulin so she could help her mother. I mean, some people would say, well, they found a syringe. They found insulin by the river. So there's a tie-in right there. But again, what if it's just coincidence?
It's so circumstantial that I don't feel you have enough for any of these people to be charged. But they all look suspicious. It's just crazy that this whole family has so much of a grudge, has so many problems. But I won't judge because I can look in the mirror and see problems with families.
Again, this is a very difficult case to cover because a little boy was murdered. I feel for the family. I feel for Christine and Jean-Marie. Judge them all you want on whether he was boastful about, you know, having money and having nice things, but he doesn't deserve to lose a child, and neither did his wife. She's trying to take care of the house and just felt like they were in a good place, a safe place. Jean-Marie talked about his decision to kill his cousin Bernard. He said that he made the decision to kill him after he went and visited his son's grave. And his quote is, "I thought he spoke to me and told me, 'Go ahead, Papa.'" He also blamed the prosecutor, the police, and the media because he felt like they had told him who had killed his boy, but then they didn't keep him. They didn't make sure that he was locked away forever. They let him go. And it was this sense of being built up like, oh, we've got the right guy. We're going to get him. And then he's out now. He's going back home to be with his family and his son. We didn't really get to know Gregory, but Jean-Marie described him as lively and tender, saying he grew up in happiness. You always had to eat lollipops with him. He danced to Michael Jackson music. I can show you the tape. He was a marvelous child. Justin, why do you think that the person who killed the boy and had been sending harassing letters and making harassing phone calls, threatening phone calls, why did they do it this way? Why take this route? Why not just go and beat up the father or something?
Well, this is trolling before we had the internet. This is the way people can harass others. You can still make harassing phone calls or write harassing letters. There was just a gay Kansas teacher the other day that received a bunch of threatening letters. So he's now moved out of the state because he feared for his life. I've had my share of people that felt like making fake accounts and going after me on Twitter or Facebook and harassing me. I know other podcasters deal with it. It's just trolling, and people have just this total lack of understanding that there is somebody on the other end, or they have an absolute understanding and they know that what they're doing is going to hurt or enrage somebody.
I really think that the turning point, because this had gone on for years with different people in the Villamon family getting calls, getting letters, I think the turning point was frustration on the part of the Crow, where they realized that they weren't really getting to Jean-Marie. And, you know, maybe it's because Jean-Marie had everything he wanted. He was happy. Like, some people can deal with pressure because they have a wife, they have a child, they have a successful job. And so maybe his life was just going too well to be derailed by all these threats. And so when the Crow discovered, wait a minute, this is never going to work, they got desperate. And the desperation turned to murder.
Well, yeah, he wasn't feeding the troll. So the troll had to resort to violence or some other means to get a reaction.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments. But business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.